aquellos de ustedes que continúan.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast where we, Sandra Andres and Laura Bach, invite fellow artists, norm breakers, researchers, scientists, and spiritual leaders to share vulnerable stories and profound insights about how we all can feel more at home with ourselves.
Together with our guests, we will examine how to break the behavioral patterns that make us feel stuck and explore how to live a more joyful, connected, and sustainable life from the inside and out.
Because we do know one thing, maybe now more than ever. Regardless of our gender identity, profession, or nationality, we are more alike than we are different. And often it is a crisis or a challenge that cracks our hearts wide open and brings us closer to ourselves.
We are so excited to have you here with us. Welcome to Coming Home.
Hello, everyone. It's great to be back. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Sandra. We've got quite an episode on for the listeners today because we're going to get into the huge and unfortunately very relevant subject of fear. How does fear affect us? And more importantly, how can we work to minimize fearful responses?
Yeah. This is a big one for me. I discovered that I am so much more motivated by fear than I thought I was. It was a very important discovery for me. And I feel like joy is also one of my driving forces, but fear easily takes over.
And as you said, it sneaks in a way sometimes where you're like, I didn't even see you there.
Exactly. And I think that's why it's so important to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So we can see it for what it is. And I think that fear is actually the ego's best friend. Like Vanessa Page, our wonderful guest from the second episode, she was saying that the ego is usually trying to communicate with you. Mm-hmm. You know, the fear of like, oh, are you supposed to do this way? Maybe you should think about it that way. Mm. Why are you doing that? Why did you say that?
Yeah.
That's the ego. So we're going to talk more about this and learn more about this today.
Because today we have the internationally acclaimed Norwegian board singer Ane Brun. Am I saying her name right?
Yeah, you're saying it very Danish-like.
Well, I'm Danish.
Ane Brun. Ane Brun.
Ane Brun. Ane Brun. Ane Brun. With us. She is here to share her personal journey of coming home. She has been facing her own fear in a very interesting way. And we also invite the renowned therapist, innovator, and the designer of the groundbreaking Lightning Process seminars, Phil Parker, to talk about how we can learn not to be the victim of our emotions.
Yes, let's get going. Ane Brun is a Norwegian songwriter, guitarist, and vocalist. She has released over 10 albums. Last year, she dropped no less than 2 albums, The Exquisite After the Great Storm and How Beauty Holds the Hand of Sorrow. The albums came out after a long period of Ane having dealt with the loss of her father, her sorrow and personal crises that included losing and finding love, as well as the climate crisis. If you have heard Ane Brun sing any of her beautiful songs or any of her heartfelt covers, you will always be able to hear that it is her. Her voice and expression is absolutely honest, ethereal, and unique, and always goes straight to the heart. Welcome, Ane Brun.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, thank you.
We're so happy to have you with us. Where are you joining us from?
In my little space in Oslo. I'm now living in both Oslo and Stockholm.
So, Ane, we have introduced to our listeners that we're going to talk about fear today. And that you have quite a remarkable journey with that yourself, that you are so gracious to share with us. So we thought, why don't we start with a part of that story and listening to that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It is 2012, and a warm summer night is embracing Stockholm. The birds are chirping, and it is bright in the room, despite the fact that it is midnight. It's a bit too bright, she thinks to herself. The mattress that she is lying on is not very comfortable either, but uncomfortable is better than being alone. Better than being at home, where the panic and anxiety would take over, and she wouldn't be able to sleep. Here, on the floor in her dear friend's apartment, she has the comfort of company, and she knows the recipe by now. Avoid being alone and get away from home. That's the only way to get some decent sleep. She feels how tense her whole body is and can't remember for how long it has been on high alert now. Days? Months? Years? The disease sneaks up on her, and she is always trying to stay ready. The fever comes and goes, but never really goes away completely. She's been here before, and it's not a good sign. It can wear her down more and more, and for each day that passes, she needs to stay vigilant. But she doesn't have time for this. She's getting ready to travel to Canada to tour the world with the legendary Peter Gabriel. Thoughts of how fun it will be and all the things that need to be in place are running through her head. Hell of a timing for the fever to come back. She has to get it under control. She has to sleep. Suddenly, she opens her eyes and stares at the ceiling. She must have fallen asleep. But a clear thought has woken her up. The thought is actually more like a loud voice inside of her that speaks slowly and lovingly, and it says, "This thing that you're doing, being this scared and worried, only makes you more sick. What you're doing in your head is not helping. Take the armor off. Just take it off." She feels how an instant sense of calm is spreading to what seems to be every single cell of her body. And for the first time in years, she is free.
Anik, tell us about this night that we just heard about. What was this sense of being free?
Well, it's kind of a before and after moment for me, because it was one of those insights that kind of just go through your whole system. And when you have those insights, it kind of stays with you and you can't really go back. Mm. I think I realized I had like a choice to try to stop being scared and stop going into a mode of emergency. I had been dealing with health issues for 10 years at that time. I got my first flare of lupus when I was 27, and this was 10 years later. And I had been working and touring all those 10 years, and I was just going on my second tour with Peter Gabriel just after that moment. And through those 10 years, it was, even though I lived a life, I had a very growing, fantastic career, have good friends and relationships, everything going on as usual. It was just that in those moments when I were on my own and trying to sleep, very often I was worried about my health. It just kind of something I dragged with me from the first serious flare of lupus. So for years I was just very worried.
Yeah, I understand that. Could you tell us what lupus is?
It's an autoimmune disease, and it's quite different from one patient to the next, and it's, you have different like ingredients.
So different symptoms and different,
yes,
for different people.
So some people have quite severe lupus where it attacks your organs and stuff like that, which is quite severe. The symptoms I've had for 3 years is fever and also blood clots, issues with blood clots. So I have to take medication for the blood clots, and then I take blood thinner, and then also a medication that kind of stabilizes the immune system. But for the just so that we have that set, for the last 6 years, I'm very, very healthy, and nothing actually shows on my test results that I have it, even though I have my medication. So
very happy to hear that.
It's good to have that. A part of the history is that I'm very, very healthy today. So
good.
And is that because of the medication?
I think it's a mix of the medication and also how I changed my perspective. And I think I really did change my perspective on stress a lot. Like, what is stress and what kind of stress is dangerous? And how do you prioritize where you can allow stress?
Wow. That's a good point.
Don't we all want to know that? Yeah. And learn that. We want to hear all about it, please. But can we go back first? Because I would love to get into that. Just wondering, when were you first diagnosed? And then this, you're saying the story we just heard was the second time that you got kind of the symptoms were coming back, and how that was different the first time from, you know, and the second time.
Yeah, the first time I got it, I was 27 and I was young. I look back now, I can see I was young. And I felt like a superhuman, didn't know I could get sick. So I was studying, I was working at a record store, I was finishing an album, I was going to start my own record label, and I was just pushing all the limits. And just a couple of months after I released my first album on my own label in the whole of Europe, and I was a beginner in the record company business, I just started getting fevers, and I was sick for a long time before they actually diagnosed me. And then they managed to find out what it was, and they gave me medication, and things kind of started getting better. But that whole period of being sick with all the uncertainties and not knowing what it was, and that total sense of losing control of your body kind of traumatized me. I'm not sure if I can totally say it's a trauma, but it feels like I had a trauma, and that I kind of entered a period of post-trauma in a way, which is something I can see afterwards, because it was like my body was holding these experiences. And every time something happened to my body, if I got pain somewhere, if I had a headache, or if I had a fever, or something that came up, immediately I just put my body on alarm, like red alert, something's wrong. And it kind of developed into a kind of panic attack thing. I walked around feeling like I was an undetonated bomb.
So would you say that the fear of not knowing what was coming next was just as great as when you would feel symptoms physically?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Yeah.
And then in 2012, I was feeling symptoms coming, like losing my hair a little bit, getting tired, getting fevers, and it just kind of came like small waves. And I just got this really, really bad feeling that this reminds me of something that happened 10 years ago.
And then you have that incident where you're lying at your friend's place and a revelation.
Yeah, it was just a couple of weeks. I don't know, maybe 3-4 weeks until I was going on that tour with Peter Gabriel. And I tried to sleep at my friend's floor just to be able to sleep, because I was too worried at home, too tense. And I woke up and I had this revelation that all of this tension and all of this kind of trying to protect myself from whatever's coming, it would just be destructive to my body. It's something I just realized instinctively. And then weirdly, after that, some things just kind of popped up. My mom sent me an article about this Norwegian woman who'd had been sick for years in one of those exhaustion syndromes, and how she managed to deal with her stress around this and the symptoms and how she got well. She was a trainer in a technique that I later learned, which is called lightning process, which is a part of the NLP training and neuro-linguistic programming. And this was like the weeks before the tour, and I actually did go to Canada. But when I landed in Quebec, I totally fell apart and was taken with an ambulance to the hospital.
She made it to Canada, where the rehearsals for the Peter Gabriel tour were starting the next day. The whole journey from Stockholm was a struggle, since she didn't feel well at all. And just as she entered the hotel room, she collapsed on the floor. She asked her bandmate Jenny to call the reception for a doctor, and after that she vaguely remembers being taken to the hospital with an ambulance. In the days that followed, the harsh reality started to become clear. She would have to let Peter Gabriel and his crew know that she wouldn't be able to do the tour, that she was too ill to even do the rehearsals. All the concerts that had been lined up, she would have to cancel everything. She felt terrible letting everyone down. Luckily, one of her own band members could fill her spot in Peter Gabriel's band, which leaves her both grateful and completely devastated. It's a blur. The plane takes her back home to Sweden, only for her to go straight to the hospital and get admitted. This will go down as the worst moment of her career, but a very profound insight is about to find her.
I think I was there for like a month or something like that. And it was strange because the first time I was sick, I was so scared all the time. And this time I had somehow come to this realization about fear and stress and everything. And even though I hadn't really dug so deep in it, I kind of had understood some things. All the physical things were really similar, but my mental state was so different. So when I, in the end, was so healthy that I could take walks and walk outside and kind of meet the world, I was hit by this amazing, like, universal love. It was so weird. I felt like I was, you know, religious or something. I was walking around just feeling that we humans were like one, and I just felt love everywhere. It was so strange. It was one of those things that you just hear about.
It's so cool to hear that. Because it's really, nothing had changed. It's just your perspective that had changed.
Yes. It was so weird because two quite similar storylines, but the result was so different. But what I did also is that once I was healthy enough, I went to do a full course of the lightning process. I think it's 5-6 steps that you do over and over and over so that you kind of program your brain. It's very scientific, which I like about it.
Mm.
We're not prisoners in our own state of minds. We have much more power to change it than we think.
Yeah.
And the more times you do it, the closer you get to that state of mind.
I mean, this is very similar. I'm going to draw this parallel to acting. Because when we do that, Laura and I mean, this is how you work. But
yeah.
It's that you actually alter your state of mind to fit what you're about to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And we practice that a lot, but then practice that with yourself is very different. Do you know what I mean? Like, it took me a while to practice that with myself, that you can actually, that's what we're doing. Getting clear tools like that, like what you found, it's really about finding what works for you, right? The tools that work for you. What do you respond to the most?
And the common denominator being you do have a choice.
Yeah.
Like what you said before, which I think is so true of a feeling for so many people, that we feel imprisoned in ourselves and we keep looping the same emotions and the same situations for ourselves and become a victim of our own lives. And you're a great example of having something in your life that is fully present. And I presume, and this is a question as well, if this is something that will, is it a long life disease that you have and then it can go many ways? Is that the nature of the disease?
Yeah, it's what they call it, a chronic disease. I have heard stories of people where it kind of has burned out, what they call it.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of just disappears in a way, but I haven't really gone into it so much. But at least for now, for the last 6 years, it feels like I don't have a disease because it doesn't show on any test results. So I'm kind of feeling like a healthy person. I think it's a combination of medication and like the treatment I got in the hospital, of course. When you get as sick as I did, it's really hard to not get out of it with medical help.
But
so,
do you think if you let's say, only had the medical help and still be where you were at when you were 26 with that same fear, holding the fear of what's going to happen next?
I'm sure I wouldn't be feeling as well as I am today.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Hmm.
I think Phil Parker has a lot of interesting things to say about placebo and expecting experiences. The big conclusion of that course for me, which is I've brought it with me all through my life afterwards in every situation, is that you are not a victim of your brain. You're not a victim of your feelings.
Your story, Anna, is so cool because it really shows very clearly that journey of coming home to yourself and that first revelation that you had without knowing all that you know now is really your body telling you that. Your whole being was telling you that, waking you up with that thought, and you could hear it. And then just from there to understand that it's a process and that you're open to it. So that moment of awareness changes everything. But then it is a process of working with yourself and finding the tools that keeps you going and makes it even more exciting and expands your awareness. I think just that's beautiful and very, very inspiring. And we can hear it in your music, Anna. It's beautiful. I love it.
Thank you. I came to think about this song that I released last year called Don't Run and Hide. And it does talk about this feelings a lot. And there's this, I really, really very seldom quote myself, but I'm going to do that now. Fear is a choice, a lonely exile, because you feel so alone when you're in fear.
Yeah.
You feel very lonely. That's my experience. If you dare to go in and change things, I feel it makes life so much more interesting. It's rewarding and brave.
Thank you for that. That's the thing, because we're not alone. It's just our perspective that changes and makes us feel that way. Thank you for coming in and for bringing all your wisdom to this space. And being so generous with your story. We really appreciate it, Anna.
Really appreciate it.
It makes me happy. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hey, Sandra, you know how we love to talk about things that are mind-blowing and amazing?
Uh-huh.
Well, Tweak Sweets is just that. And I know that you know why, but for those of our lovely listeners that do not know why, could you just give them a quick rundown of this amazing candy?
Absolutely. Tweak Sweets has hold on to your horses. 95% less sugar. It has natural flavors and colors and up to 50% less calories. Plus, it is high in fibers.
I mean, come on. What's not to eat right?
Exactly. Go to tweaksweets.com and have a taste of what we are talking about.
And now with us, we have Phil Parker, the health and happiness expert. He's a renowned therapist, innovator, and the designer of the groundbreaking Lightning Process Seminars, which has transformed the health and lives of over 25,000 people globally.
He is also a university lecturer in NLP, self-hypnosis and hypnosis, live coaching and osteopathy. He is also the director of the Phil Parker Training Institute, where he researches and assigns programs and trains students.
Welcome, Phil. We're so glad to have you with us.
Are you in London?
I'm actually in Brighton, which is on the coast.
We're so happy you're with us, that you're joining us for this new podcast called Coming Home.
So we've just been talking to Anna Braun, telling her story about living with the chronic illness lupus and how she had to learn to deal with the rampant fear it caused her to feel. Now, one of the many things you teach people is how not to be the victims of their emotions, which is definitely something I think we can all benefit from learning a bit more about. Can you maybe shed some light on how we can start doing that?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's an interesting bit of science around this, which is, first of all, stress occurs in life, in everybody's life. And basically, it's your body having to deal with something. Okay, so something surprising, maybe something potentially threatening, something unexpected. So we're just going along normally and then something happens and our body has to respond and our mind has to respond. And in terms of how we think about stress, we're not just talking about mental stress. We're talking about stress like sunburn is a stress on the body, a load on the body. So lots of things cause pressure or load, tension within the body system. The body has to respond to it. And what's interesting about stress is stress isn't bad for us at all. It's actually quite good for us. Having a little bit of intrigue, a little bit of pressure is okay. But long-term stress or overwhelming stress causes a very different response to the body. So a little bit about the physiology might help at this point, which is when, let's say you're at school and you're tilting back on your chair when we're teenagers and we tilt back on the chair. And sometimes you go a little bit too far and you feel your whole body going, ah! That's an instant triggering of a kind of a response of your body going, ah, something's going on here, we need to deal with it. And you can feel suddenly this kind of heat and this feeling rushing through your body. That's the sympathetic nervous system, which is designed specifically to keep you safe. And basically what it does is it turns on all the kind of systems that will get you to run away or fight the problem you've got. And this is called the flight and fight response. And temporarily that's fine. But to do that, it steals energy from other systems that we really need. But we don't need when we're running away from, say, danger, but we generally need. So it switches off your digestion, sedates that. It switches off the way you process food. It switches off your sleep. It switches off clever and creative thinking. It goes for kind of much more reflexive thinking, like, oh, danger, run. And probably most importantly, it switches off your immune system, particularly if this stress system is switched on for a long time. So if we don't deal with, we don't learn how to deal with these kind of emotions, it can have really serious health consequences. So there's some kind of background to why this is actually a really important question that you ask. How do we stop being victims of our emotions? And part of the problem is we have kind of a primitive neurology, which is designed to look for danger, because evolutionarily, it's really important to know where danger is. And the kind of danger that we used to face would be tigers, which would either eat us or we would run away from. But it would take quite a short period of time, not like a 4-year degree or a 10-year marriage or a 25-year mortgage. So our body constantly gets into stress and states and emotions. And most of us have no idea how to switch from one state to another. So we'll hear people saying things like, well, of course I was pissed off, the train was late, or the traffic was bad. You know, how else was I supposed to feel about it? Can that be different? Can we have a different response?
Yeah, because is it serving you, I presume, is the question.
Yes, but even if people recognize that it's not useful, which is a great starting point, they still often don't have the mechanical tools to go, well, I don't know how I switch from here to there. A lot of people throughout history have kind of grappled with this, and the core conversation is what we need to do. And actually, there's a really nice one, which is the Serenity Prayer, which you may have heard. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and rather brilliantly, the wisdom to know the difference between those two things.
Yes.
If you see wrong, you should do something about it, but equally you should accept the things you cannot change. And that really encapsulates that whole conversation. Like, there are things we can change and there are things we can't change. And if we put all our energy into trying to change the things we can't, like, why is the traffic like this? This is so annoying. Why am I late? Well, you can't do anything about that. And instead look at, well, what can we do something about? Then we start to get wise, becoming responsible for how we're responding to stuff, which is a big ask, but it's really, really important.
And very, very empowering is what I'm thinking when listening to you explaining it. That's where you find your power, your choice.
It kind of cuts both ways. It is really empowering, but some people take it on as like, oh, I've got to do this as well. I'm in the traffic jam and now I've got to feel okay about it. Oh, man. Or if you move into healthcare, if you're ill, that can seem like, oh, I'm ill and now I've got to sort out my nervous system. That sounds like too much to do. And a lot of the work I do is helping people to do that. And you have to go on quite a long conversation to move from, I'm ill and how am I supposed to do anything, to, oh, okay, I get this. I get how I could be powerful and empowered. So as you say, it is an empowering conversation, but we've got to be really careful to make sure people don't feel blamed for, so quite often people will take the word responsibility to go, what you're saying, I'm responsible for being ill, rather than what we're saying is it's about how you have the capacity or potential to influence what happens next.
Would you say that many people are walking around in survival mode without even knowing that that's the kind of society that we have built.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think we have been living a lot in threat, a lot in overwhelm. Mm. Technology, which is a beautiful thing. I love technology, but it means there's very little downtime. People are always on, always available. People were working longer hours. Emails come in. You know, I had this last week where I was just checking my emails for another reason and I saw a difficult email I had to deal with. Normally that you wouldn't see that until, the end of the weekend. Yeah.
I think so people can recognize that.
Yeah, it's more easy to get broken into and not a very good state by stuff, for sure. In the pandemic, of course, we've got a whole bunch of other things. We've got lack of really important things like human connection. So being physically connected to people, which produces oxytocin, it reduces your sympathetic nervous system arousal. It's really good for us on so many levels. Changes our amygdala, this little part of the bottom part of our brain. Mm-hmm. And when we didn't have connection, physical connection, we get it a bit actually through social media, but not as strongly as when we see people. So all that's been missing. Some people have enjoyed lockdown because they haven't had to do the things they don't like doing. Let's say they don't like social situations. Now they're having to go out to the situations they don't normally deal with. They've managed to escape. Yeah. So there's all sorts of extra things coming on that are not just about the fear of the virus and the fear of the illness, but a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, going back to that, exactly what you're saying is that can be very stressful. So feel like the social life that you lived before, just like Laura was referring to, it was quite stressful. And maybe you have found during this time that you have calmed down a bit, if you've been able to approach yourself that way and the stillness in that way, then going back can be extremely triggering, I'm thinking. And how to deal with that?
Well, this is one of the things. The core solution that we usually have for difficult emotions is to avoid the situations where they occur. Right. So if we don't like crowds, we just don't go near them. If we don't like spiders, we stay away from certain places that we think, in fact, spider phobics are experts on knowing which rooms are likely to have spiders in. And they spend the whole time scanning for not going in that room. So one of the ways we deal with stuff is by just not going there. But unfortunately, then our world often becomes smaller and smaller. It's not a great strategy because it makes you very kind of dependent on creating a safe space. Where nothing random occurs spontaneously. And that's actually quite a dull way to live. What everybody else is pointing towards, all these ancient philosophers and the kind of stuff that I do, is like, okay, well, how then, coming back to what we talked about earlier, how do we not be a victim of our emotions? How do we steer our brain in a different direction? And there's some really interesting things you can do that will instantly allow you to regain choice as to which direction your brain points. So one of the most interesting things that's going on in brain science at the moment is the idea of neuroplasticity. So neuroplasticity, which some people know about and others don't, so I'll quickly explain it. They used to think the brain was a bit like an electrical circuit board, that when you lay down a pathway, that's how it is. So if your TV has got a little bit of wire that's burnt into the circuit board, that's how it is. And then they discovered that the brain is actually much more like the internet. So in the internet, if your podcast becomes really successful and everybody wants to see it, then suddenly it will appear on Google rankings and more people will go there. And the pathways, the internet nodes that point towards it will increase. And the brain is the same. So fundamentally with neuroplasticity, if you use a pathway a lot, it becomes very strong. So pathways you use the most become easier to access. And we all experience this. Let's say you've had a day where you're getting pissed off and annoyed by different people. By the end of the day, somebody just says one tiny thing and you explode because you're already, your brain is already going in that direction. Equally, if we have a day where we're really feeling good, we're able to tolerate stuff in a different way. So if we keep on going down a pathway that's, let's say, negative, that's not good for us, that's not useful, that becomes stronger. And that hits us on two levels. Doesn't feel very good. It can affect our physiology. But probably most importantly, we're actually wiring our brain to make it easier to feel that way again. So if you spend a lot of time in stress, it's easier to be stressed. And what actually happens is that the pathways move together. So there's a little gap between one nerve pathway and another. And if you use it a lot, that gap gets smaller, physically smaller. So it changes the architecture of your brain as a result of usage. Mm. But the cool thing about neuroplasticity is it's always on. It's always observing. Right? So if you then start to use different pathways, like you start to use the pathway of calmness or at peace or acceptance or happiness, and you do that lots, then again, neuroplasticity comes into play and that pathway starts to become strong and the old pathway starts to fade and move away. And there's again a physical change in your brain. So neuroplasticity really kind of opens up the conversation about, it's not that I am a stressed person. It's just that somehow I've practiced these pathways a lot. So it's become easy for me to do that. But if I've trained myself to do that, it would mean equally, I could train myself to do happy or do calm.
We just talked about with Anna this situation of having a chronic illness, something in your life that will always be there. Could you maybe talk a little bit about how to deal with that?
The first thing with chronic illnesses, so chronic means long term, is sometimes we are told they're chronic because everything medicine has to offer has run out of usefulness, and they go, there's nothing we can do. And sometimes how that's said is there is nothing that can be done rather than there's nothing you can do. So sometimes we need to check in and go, are there other options? But, you know, in some cases, there aren't. This is just what you've got.
Yeah.
The question then, it kind of comes back to the serenity prayer. It's like, which bits can I change? If I can't change it, then there's no point in putting any energy into that because I can't change it. But what can I change? Can I change how I feel about it? How can I change how optimistic I am about things changing? So when you're dealing with it with a chronic illness, it's like checking in, making sure that you're changing whatever you can, whether that's changing how you think about it or changing how you work with your body to encourage your immune system to do different things. Because it's extraordinary. If you look at most illnesses, there will be some cases of people who have made extraordinary change. So, you know, there are interesting options. It doesn't mean to say everybody can make change, but it's thinking about, well, I wonder what I could do.
I'm just curious to hear if you have some hands-on advice that you teach, you know, that is some good first steps to practice with yourself.
There's lots of stuff we can do. So let me give you some things that make a difference. When people are anxious, they usually talk in quite a fast way. Okay. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And they start to talk in a high-pitched voice. There's a problem with this in that this ramps up your kind of feelings of anxiety. It changes your breathing rate because if we think fast thoughts or we speak fast, our breathing has to match it. So just by slowing down your voice, the speed at which you talk about, bringing maybe the tonality of your voice down a bit from to talking slower, talking in a more measured way. And whether that's talking out loud or talking inside, because we have a speed of our internal voice, which you can also slow down on purpose, that will make you feel calmer. And you may notice that as I've been talking slower, you find yourself slowing down a bit too. And that's because we have something called mirror neurons. So mirror neurons are designed to specifically pay attention to other humans. Other species have them as well, but we have them. And it's part of being a social animal. Again, I think it's an evolutionary thing. It's more safe for us to be part of a tribe rather than to be a lone wolf. It's safer. So when we meet people, we want them to know, look, we're like you. I'm like you. It's safe. I can be your friend. And so we have this neuron, these neurons, which are specifically designed to borrow, match, copy behaviors. And so interestingly, the state we're in is contagious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and you probably found this, if you hang around people who are stressed, it can be stressful. If you hang around people who are really flat all day long, you can end up feeling quite flat. And if you hang around people who are optimistic, that makes a huge difference. And if you're actors, then you know about this, that all acting is about getting the audience into the state that you want to be conveying. And yeah, getting yourself absolutely. Into it enough that you can spread that at distance and people go, oh, I really get that. Yeah. And that's triggering those mirror neurons. So the first thing, if people want to change their state, is slow down internally or in your voice. And just by doing that, that will make a huge difference. Second tip I would give you, and you can try this out. If you have somebody who's annoying you, okay, although technically it's not actually accurate. It's not they annoying you. It's you are creating annoyance in yourself. But let's pretend they're annoying you, someone who you find difficult to be around. Mm. If you can think of anyone like that, then what I'd like you to do is just to picture them in your mind and notice where you see them. So if you guys want to do that, just point to wherever you see this person who's slightly annoying. Just point in space. Where do you see them?
I'm pointing right in front of me.
Yeah.
Like literally here. Right.
Good. Yeah. So above your eyes, and yours is to your left. And both of you are slightly above your eye level. And this is very interesting. When we have people and we put them above our eye level, that makes us feel a little bit like they're dominant, domineering, because they're above us. Okay. Mm. So the first thing you do is you shrink them down to the size of a peanut. Okay. And then you drop them down to the floor, usually to your left, so they're about 2 meters away from you. So see that person, the size of a peanut, on the floor over there. And as you
cute.
Do that...
So cute!
Notice how that changes how you feel. It usually, what that does is it gives you a sense of space. It reduces the power that they've had over you.
I can't be angry with that person
with a peanut lying 2 meters to your left.
And you can have them go hundreds of meters away. You can have them go to Australia or the other part of the planet. And that changes how you feel about them. And that's really important, because quite often we can get stressed about people when they're not even there. You know, like we can go, oh, if they were here and they saw me doing this, or when they come back from holiday, they're going to be grrr, and they're not even there. So this is all internally generated, you know, where we're creating stress for ourselves. So doing stuff like this, which comes from NLP, this is called submodality work. There's all sorts of interesting things you can do to change what your brain is doing. Once you recognize what it's doing, there are some tools to help to get it to do something different. So there's a couple of things that will instantly make a difference. The third thing I'd recommend is to spend some time allowing your brain to focus on nice things. So if you spend a lot of time thinking about stressful things, or the things you've got to do, or your to-do list, or what you haven't done, then you're wiring your brain constantly into the neurology that you don't want to be waking up and building. So it's imagine like taking your brain down to the gym. Yeah, you don't want to be exercising those pathways. You want to be exercising the other. So put some time into reconnecting and re-immersing with some amazing moments of your life, because we all have extraordinary moments, you know. So if you guys think for a minute about what for you is a really, really deeply relaxing moment in your life. So it might be a holiday, might be somewhere natural, nature, might be with some people, whatever it is. Allow yourself to connect with it. And as you do, start to notice what you see by being here. The things, the colors, the shapes. Notice the sounds and stillnesses and silences that you hear both outside and within you. And notice how your body feels in this place. And just by doing that, it allows you to reconnect with that. And that will settle your nervous system. It will enhance your immune system. It will do all sorts of really, really, really good things for you. Or, you know, we have so many extraordinary moments. And yet how little time do we spend thinking about those compared to, oh, I must pay my tax bill, the car needs repairing.
And why did I say that?
You know, we have this amazing brain and we spend so much of its power processing fairly shitty, shabby thoughts that aren't that empowering, when we could take a moment to just point it in a slightly different direction. And that would have two effects. Number one, we would feel better, but probably more powerfully and more importantly, we would be rebuilding or building pathways into accessing that memory more readily in the future. And that's really important. So spend some time choosing what thoughts you have, choosing which memories you immerse yourself in. And by doing that, that will have a huge effect.
Phil, we have been speaking to Anna, talking about how she's been very helped by your, because I'm sure you are the teacher of many things, but one of the things is the lightening process. Can you maybe, I'm sure you've already covered quite a lot of it, but maybe more specifically tell us about what that is.
Yeah, so following on from a lot of what I've talked about, the lightening process is a training program that teaches you what we're thinking affects our brain, which affects our body. It's also two-way. What our body does affects our brain, which affects how we think. Research is very clear about this. So it's this kind of two-way street. What the lightning process looks at is, how do we hack into that system? How do we become influential in making sure that our brain is being helped by what we're thinking and our body is helping our brain? How do we take all that and move ourselves forwards? How do we activate pathways that enhance our life and well-being? And how do we stop using the pathways that aren't that useful? And the first step of that is, of course, becoming aware, noticing when you are. And that's, you know, a lot of people just running around without even recognizing that they're in stress or that they're not in very happy places. So becoming aware of that and then finding a way to pause those pathways, to choose different pathways. And then really a key part of the lightening process is teaching people how to start to be nice to themselves, start to be compassionate to themselves. If you were to listen to some of the things that people say in their heads, and you just referred to this a minute ago, when people go, oh, why did I say that? Oh, you idiot, you know, these kind of conversations. If you said them to your friends, would you have any? You know, if you talk to your friends like that, they would run. Like, I don't want to be around you. You're just toxic. And yet a lot of people are doing this to themselves all the time. So changing those conversations. And again, there's some really interesting research on the power of our internal conversations. Another interesting tip is, if you say to yourself something like, you know, you want to change your conversation from you're an idiot to, you know, I think you're great. The I statements are not nearly as powerful as you statements. So if you say you are great to yourself, it actually has been shown to have a much bigger impact.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Because the affirmations you hear about are usually put in I form.
No, the you is much more powerful because it sounds like somebody else is saying it to you.
Yeah.
Although it's not, it's obviously you, but it has that quality of, it's not just you saying it, it's me and this other person. So yeah, the research is pretty clear that you statements have a bigger impact than I statements.
Wow. It makes sense. Absolutely. I just want to say that, just to touch on what you were just saying, is that it's not always easy to even hear and catch those thoughts, that what you say to yourself. And I'm speaking just for myself. It took me a long time to realize that I was so hard on myself. And I'm that kind of person that I've been very good at keeping busy all the time, because I feel like that kind of has made me feel worthy and like I am contributing with something. So you keep busy all the time. If you're not watching something, maybe I'm watching something on the computer and I'm doing something else at the same time. You know, it's like filling up every second of your time instead of just giving yourself a bit of stillness. And then it's impossible to hear yourself. And I just think that that's something that I just want to bring that up, because I think a lot of people hopefully can relate to that, that I'm not alone in thinking so, because that our whole society is just about doing as much as you can in a day.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that thing you mentioned there, being aware, that's the first step. First step really of any program is to become mindful of what is going on, because until you notice that, you can't do anything about it. So a final thought is, there's some really interesting research, and this is part of the lightning process, into the power of words. So if you say the word stress, it has an effect on your body. If you say the word pain, it actually triggers your pain processing centers. Now, the really interesting thing, and I've got a dog, a lovely dog called Luna, who you will see on my Instagram and my website. And she knows what the word walk means, right? So if I say, hey, we're going on a walk, she's like, oh my God, she's really excited. She runs around, she woofs. But if I say to her, look, I've got to do a podcast, I can't take you for a walk, she has exactly the same response. She hears the word walk.
It's like, walk.
Yes. Walk.
Yeah.
And our brains are the same. So if we say, listen, I'm really stressed, that actually increases our stress. But if we say, right, I don't want to be stressed, it does exactly the same because the word triggers the pathway. So even becoming aware that some of our language, even when we're trying to get ourselves out of the hole, like I mustn't be hard on myself, I mustn't tell myself I'm shit. As soon as we do that, we're actually building ourselves back into the problem. So learning to shift language, which shifts neurology, is a huge part of the learning process and something that's really easy to do once you're aware that's what you're doing.
Oh, I love that you're saying this. And it is a beautiful way to end this conversation, that it, the importance of words, and because you can feel them, actually, when you use them, you can really feel your, how your body responds to them, right?
And that could be on the note of slowly reintegrating in society with everything that you have taught us today, Phil, with taking things more slowly, being aware of your own reactions and maybe focusing on the what do I want instead of the what don't I want.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Phil Parker.
Pleasure.
If you want to get in contact with Phil Parker and learn more about his work, please visit cominghomepodcast.com. There, you can also deep dive and get more information on the subjects we touched upon today. You can always drop us a line there or on Instagram or Facebook and let us know what resonated with you when you listened to today's episode. We would love to hear from you.
And thank you again to our amazing partner, Tweak Sweets. That makes candy with natural flavors and colors. They are filled with fibers and have 95% less sugar than regular candy. Mm-hmm. As a listener, you can go to their website, tweaksweets.com, and use the code COMINGHOME20 and get 20% off a whole purchase. So go check out all the different delicious candy they make and find your favorite one.
The editing and sound mix of this episode is made by the great Rahmatullah Sheikh. Our theme music is made by the wonderful Caroline Jungstrom, and our website is designed by the great women at Seth & Osten Communication Bureau.
Thank you for listening to Coming Home with me, Laura Buck, and Sandra Andres. Take care, and remember, be kind to yourselves till next time.